hope you are well prepared for a very big weekend in sports. College hoops is a big Saturday, and then, of course, the Super Bowl on Sunday. Welcome back into the Ion College Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Norlander. Feel free to follow me on Twitter, at Matt Norlander. Send any suggestions, praise, damning praise, or any sort of hateful correspondence. I welcome it all. Today's podcast brings back on Jay Billis, and Jay will be in Bloomington for a big one Saturday night between Michigan and Indiana, and it'll be the third meeting between top five teams this season. That's going to be a good one. We'll get to that in just a little bit. But first, Jay, welcome back, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. I'm enjoying the season, and I'm glad that football's wrapping up. I love me some football, but once the Super Bowl ends, I think that's truly, everyone, you know, says come the new year, come conference season, come to the end of college football season. Really, as a nation, people start paying more attention once the Super Bowl's over. I know a lot of people tend to say that, you know, March Madness is only when people pay attention. I don't think that's true. I think a lot of sports fans do start to realize the trends, the storylines, and what's happening in the sport once this big final football game finishes up.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that conference play, a lot of people turn their attention to it, but until the Super Bowl's over, that's when the mainstream media really starts to look at college basketball. I don't know if it's because they feel like there's nothing left, but and plus we're in the stretch run, and we've become such a tournament-driven sport that that until the tournament is in sight, the average fan probably doesn't pay as much attention as the purists and those who are immersed in it would like.
Yeah, and it's so typical that we've got this awesome game between arguably the two best teams in the best conference this year. And don't get me wrong, I mean, you're going there, ESPN's building up game day. I'm plenty pumped for it, but it's been totally overshadowed by the Super Bowl, and it's just kind of an indication of where college basketball can be sometimes. What are you doing for the Super Bowl? I mean, do you fly home, you do a little party at the house? Do the Billises host a big get together, or are you not even too much of a football guy?
No, I'm going straight from Bloomington, from Indiana, Michigan to Louisville. I've got Marquette, Louisville on Sunday at 2:00. And then I'm going to stick around in Louisville and watch the Super Bowl with my brother who lives there. And then I've got a Syracuse game on Monday night.
Look at that. There you go, man. Book solid. Appreciate you taking some time here. We can go right to the big game first and set it up here. Michigan, Indiana, that's going to be the big one. So what should fans expect out of this? Those that might have seen Michigan one or two times, might have seen Indiana one or two times. These are top five teams that can win the title without a doubt. Very fun to watch. I have seen Michigan in person this year, and they're extremely fun to watch in person. But what are your expectations from this game, and who do you ultimately think will win it?
Well, the last part first, Indiana's won 14 of the last 15 against Michigan in Bloomington, so I think it's a big hill to climb, even though the Wolverines are number one and can beat absolutely anybody anywhere. I think what fans who don't watch these teams all the time would be a little bit surprised at is that Michigan is really, really good in transition. If you look like you and I do at these KenPom.com stats, all the tempo free stuff, and you look at the pace of play, you know, Michigan falls down to in the bottom half of Division One. I think they're in the 250, 260 range in pace of play, but they are really fast in transition. And when they get an outlet pass, loose ball, turnover, whatever, off a rebound, once Trey Burke gets the ball, it's two dribbles to half court. You know, that's sort of their speed slot. And they've got wings that can really run. I mean, Glenn Robinson and Tim Hardaway can really run. And Mitch McGarry is a big guy, can really run. Jordan Morgan, when healthy, can really run. And if you don't take them out of transition and keep them from getting easy baskets, they're going to beat you. I don't think there's any question. They're the most efficient team I've seen when they get in transition of anybody in the country.
Who's the best player on the floor Saturday night, in your opinion?
I think Trey Burke is the best player overall, and then I would say that after that, it would be Cody Zeller. I differ with some of my colleagues that say that Victor Oladipo is better than Zeller. Now, I think he's a more complete player because he does so many things, and he's so disruptive on the defensive end. But I really do believe if you take Cody Zeller off that team, they would be scrounging to get 20 wins. I think Zeller's that important because, you know, he gets a lot of steals. He gets a lot of, you know, he's a very good offensive rebounder. He really runs the floor and drags the defense with him. It opens up a lot of things for other players. And he's so efficient getting to the free throw line. But I think the most disruptive player and the guy that can really impact it the most, in a disruptive way, if that's the right term, is Oladipo, because, you know, he's a great driver. He can go either way off the dribble. You go under a screen, he is now making open shots if he has a little bit of time. And he gets a ton of deflections and steals, and, he's physical on the defensive end, so he can guard a point guard. He can guard a three man, guard a two. The one thing he can't guard is the only thing that Zeller excels in guarding, and that's a five man. That's one of the things that makes Zeller so valuable.
Yeah, no, Zeller's been good. I think Zeller's been an interesting case this year because he had such an awesome season last season that I said before the year started, I thought it would be tough for him to totally duplicate what he did because of how good that season was, and then you took into account all the talent Indiana had coming back and the natural growth of the team. And so we had a bit of an unrealistic expectation bar set for Zeller. And yet, like if you ask, you know, my own colleagues don't have him in top five for player of the year consideration. He is fifth on KenPom's formulaic, totally objective statistical evaluation for player of the year. He is fifth there. But you side more with the fact that Zeller's actually been pretty damn good. And as you said, his presence alone and what he does makes Indiana a team worth winning the title. Whereas, and I hadn't thought of it that way, but I do. I'm trying to picture, and I think I do agree. If Zeller wasn't on this team, I can't see them competing for top three even in the Big Ten.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they didn't win before he got there. And that's not to say that you know, when Victor Oladipo was a freshman, all of a sudden, you know, they can't win because he's there by himself. I mean, you know, the good news is, Matt, we don't have to make a choice. They're both on the team. And so this is all kind of barroom talk about who's their best player and who's their most valuable player and who's their most complete player and all that stuff. I think you take either one of them off the team, they take a huge hit. But I think it is. I think you're exactly right that, you know, our expectations of Zeller, you know, oh my God, you know, he's only the fifth best player in the country or the fifth most efficient. You know, what a letdown. And Oladipo has been leaps and bounds better this year than he was last year, the year before. His improvement has been, I can't remember seeing a player that's improved as much from one year to the next. You know, he couldn't make a perimeter shot last year. And this year he's shooting over 50% from three. He's the leading percentage shooter in the country right now. Effective field goal percentage. He's been tremendous and he's a great defender. Everything's kind of come together for him, and it's not by happenstance. It's because he really works at it. But, you know, to all of a sudden say because he's made this jump that, well, now Cody Zeller, you know, kind of doesn't matter, that he's the guy, I think is a little bit dismissive of how important Zeller is. But you know what, Matt? Reasonable minds can differ on that. And the beauty is, like I said before, we don't have to choose. They're both on the team. But it's funny. We just don't have this conversation about other teams and other players where we're, you know, spending time arguing over who's their best player, like it really matters.
Yeah, that's a good point. Talking to Jay Billis, who's on his way to Bloomington right now. Give listeners an idea of what you do when you go on, you know, 8 weeks a year, you do the game day thing, you fly in. So what will you do today? Will you sit down with both coaches? Will you sit in on practice? Will you go over with your crew what the topics will be on for the, you know, your show in the morning tomorrow, or has that already been discussed? What is the actual process here for you?
Well, it's a good question. We do a lot during the week to talk about things that would be worthwhile to go through on the show. So we're prepared by the time we get there about the topics we may hit on. We have a meeting today on Friday before the show tomorrow, that we go over everything, but we try not to have the show in the meeting, if that makes sense. We want everything to be fresh. And if there's going to be disagreement, we don't want to have the disagreement outlined and sort of forecast before we have the show. So we try to keep the meetings tight, and we do a pretty good job with that. But today, like I'm headed to Bloomington right now. I'm going to speak to a group at 1 o'clock, like a student group on campus, and then go through all the meetings. And I usually do go to practices on Friday. I like to see the teams, and any time I get a chance to spend time with the teams or the coaches and watch them in practice or meetings or scouting, I take advantage of it. And then I'll do the same tomorrow at shoot-arounds if I can. I mean, sometimes we have TV duties that go through those things, but I don't really prepare any differently for a game than I do for a game day or anything like that. I like to think I'm immersed in it all the time, so I'm always preparing. But, I'll talk to coaches during the week, not just the coaches that we're going to see on game day. Because, as you know, Matt, the game day thing isn't always just about the teams that are playing in the game. It's more a national look, and you try to showcase where you are. But the people at home, they may be interested in games other than this. So we're trying to be a clearinghouse for the entire landscape. And so you can get bogged down a little bit too much in the game in front of you instead of just making sure you touch on everything that's important.
Yeah, you guys do a pretty good job with that. And you had mentioned how you try and bring authentic discussion to the game day set as it's happening. It's actually what I kind of try and do here on the podcast. I very seldom will let a guest know what we're going to talk about because it's better to keep them on their toes. And sometimes good natural disagreement can come from that. And so I've got a question for you. I saw you guys, I think it was on the debut. You said college basketball is as physical as it's ever been, and it's more physical than the NBA. And then Jalen Rose really disagreed with you. And I've seen a lot of people disagree with you in this. So I need you to, you've got plenty of room to stretch your legs here. No time constraints on the podcast. Explain to people your position here. How could, obviously the best athletes, the biggest, strongest men make the NBA. How could the NBA have a softer game than college these days?
Well, it depends on, I go Clintonian on you, what your definition of physical is. I understand and realize that if you run in to Dwight Howard or Shaquille O'Neal or the like, it is not the same as running into Cody Zeller or Nerlens Noel right now. Mm-hmm. That's not my point. And you're right about the athleticism and all that. My point is that in the NBA, you're not allowed to mug a ball handler like you can in college. You can't put your hands all over them. And when Kobe Bryant or Dwayne Wade or whoever, when they make a pass and cut through the lane, they're untouched. You are not allowed to bump them off their path, chuck them, grab them, wrap your arms around them. In college, Matt, as you see it, I mean, I watch tape all the time. I slow it down. It is remarkable. You cannot run cuts right now because the defenses are so good at bumping you off your cuts. It's not just they get to a spot and force you to go around them, which is the way it should be. They ride you off your cuts. And the NFL doesn't allow that with wide receivers, and we allow it in college. And the other thing that happens, and I think, observers of the game, maybe not the people who watch it as closely as we do, but, just the average fan, if they get their TiVo out, watch when a player gets the ball inside and the defensive player is between him and the basket and has his hands up. And what they do is they put their hands up and kind of their elbows behind their ears so they don't bring their hands down. And they use their body and bump the player as they go up with their body. Mm-hmm. And most coaches are calling it, they say, foul them with your chest. And so we are sanctioning fouling. Stuff that would be called fouls in the NBA without question is normal basketball right now in college. And is it ruining the game? I don't know that I'd go that far, but it's affecting it negatively. And people go, well, there are too many ball screens. One of the reasons that there are so many ball screens is because it's really hard to run any kind of other offense because of all the bumping and grinding and grabbing. It disrupts timing, and it bumps you off your path. You can't make these cuts, and it makes it really difficult to run any kind of continuity-based or motion-based offense. And it's really affecting the game. And Matt, one last thing. I think all you have to do is look at some of the players that were good. They did well in college. They go up to the NBA and they're much more effective. Well, how can that be? How can that be if the athletes are so much better and all that stuff? It's because the game in college is not officiated properly. And that, I'm not laying this on the officials. I'm laying it on the administrators of the game. We don't make the officials do it. And they've been able to take the easy way out, and they're not calling all the fouls that they should call. We defer to the defense instead of deferring to the offense. You can mug a guy making a cut, and then if an offensive player leans in 6 inches on a screen, we call an illegal screen. It goes the other way. It's not conducive to scoring, And I've always felt like this game should be about passing, cutting, handling, and shooting. And now it's about scouting reports and who can bump cutters and all that stuff. And it's more clutch and grab than it's ever been. And I think that's what I meant by physical. And I think the evidence backs it up. And every NBA scout I talk to agrees with me. And I may not have laid it out very well to Jalen. We've talked about it afterwards. I think he understands my position on it. But I really believe it. I think it's really hurt the game.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And I had a piece go up Thursday. I did a quick little one on Belmont. They're really good again. I talked with Rick Bird earlier in the week. Really good coach. They've had a lot of success. And he told me, he's like, I'm not a huge fan of the ball screen offense. I love running the motion. I love having a five down back to the basket and kind of spraying things out around him. But with our roster and with the way college basketball is, I kind of had no choice but to go to ball screen. And here we are. We've got a couple of guards. Ian Clark and Victor Oladipo are actually the two best effective field goal shooters in the country. And it's been successful for them. And I thought that itself was just a little bit of a commentary of where the game is today with the ball screen. When you've got coaches that are, you know, 59 years old, had plenty of success. They don't want to run it, but they do it begrudgingly. And it's still successful. I thought that was interesting. And I do think you've got a point here. I do agree that the college game is too stagnated. Basketball should be a free-flowing. It should be, someone once said it should be like a jazz. It should be like a jazz solo. You know, it should be unpredictable in how it unfolds, but yet you kind of see where it's going, what it's doing. And now we've got a lot of, and I don't begrudge the half court game. I just feel that that it's just gotten so micromanaged. And this is kind of indicative of how the game itself can be micromanaged by coaches, because if you can slow it down, if you can play foul players with their chest, like you're saying, I think that's why we've got a problem with scoring overall. And, you know, Jabe, Rick Bird's, he's on the committee for rules changes. And he said this is something that concerns him. And he said come this spring, they're going to have serious discussions about altering the game. So I guess that's at least a positive. I didn't know if you had heard anything similar, rumblings about how coaches are frustrated with the fact that scoring averages are down and things are, at least they're going to try and see how they can adjust the game going forward here.
Yeah, I know. I've heard a lot of it. And, you know, listen, Rick is a great coach and a great guy. He's a great golfer. He's a lot of great things. You know, but the rules committee has a lot of coaches on it. And a lot of these coaches have differing interests, that if you're at a place that that has a hard time getting the great athletes, you want to bump and grind and hold. And I'm fine with half-court games and managing the clock and making it a shorter game. I think that's fine. That's good strategy. Like, this is the way I look at it, Matt. You can hold the ball. That's fine. That is absolutely allowable, and I have zero problem with it. You cannot hold your opponent. But that is not the coach's fault. The coach is teaching that stuff. They're teaching the foul them with your chest thing and getting your arm bar into the hip of the offensive player to push him and to bump him off his path. They're teaching bumping cutters. They're doing all that. They're teaching it. And the referees complain that the coaches are teaching it. And whenever I talk to an official, and the officials I talk to are all great, they get it. But one of the things I say is they're teaching it because you won't call it. And, you know, people will say, wait, we don't need more fouls called in the game. We don't need the game slowed down. That's not the way it works. The more fouls you call, the fewer fouls there will be. Players will stop fouling. They will adjust. The fewer fouls you call when there are fouls, the more people will endeavor to foul. It's like in football. If you allow holding, they're going to hold. And if you call it, they're going to stop because they don't want to get sent back 10 yards. They don't want to lose field position. And players want to stay in the game, and coaches want to. So it's up to the administrators of the game to clean this up. And I don't think, look, I've never heard anybody complain after a basketball game going, you know what, that 89-88 game, that's just not that's not the kind of basketball I want to see. I want to see the 49-48 game and watch two teams grind it out. That's just not the way people view the game in my opinion.
Yeah, and we should get a good look at something closer to 89-88 with Michigan and Indiana. I want to go kind of random stuff here. Most underrated team in the country right now, in your opinion, would be who, Jay?
Miami. I think Miami's really good. They're not athletic. They're not super athletic. They've got good athletes. But I've said this before. I don't mean to beat it to death. But they really do remind me of a bunch of old guys that get to the Y you know, they got their duffel bags. They just came from work, and they're kind of creaky, and they've got their, you know, they put their braces on and everything, and then they get on the floor, and they just kick your ass. They don't get down the court as fast, but when they get down, they just get their body into you and lock into you, and they know how to play. And I think they're going to be hard to deal with because they control tempo, and they're older, and they're smart, and they're not trying to impress anybody. They're just trying to win.
Truly a team that's good enough that's got, you know, Elite Eight or better kind of ceiling, Miami? Are they that good?
I think so, but that's the thing, Matt. It's like it depends on your path. I mean, the more I've been around the tournament since I was a player, the more I've realized it's not so much about, you know, where do you rank among the teams or who do you think's best. It's about your individual path. And, you know, something will happen in your bracket. You know, I mean, I don't know if I told you this, but you know, when I was in college, my senior year, we were the number one overall seed in the tournament, and Coach K brought us in the locker room and, you know, showed us the bracket, and he kind of pointed out the other side of the bracket from us, you know, the 32 teams on the other side of the bracket back when it was 64 teams. And he said, look at this other side of the bracket, how many good teams there are. And he says, who cares what happens over there? Only one team's coming out of there. We'll play them Monday night. We don't care. We only care about our path. And that really made the tournament easier for me to wrap my head around at that time. And I think a lot of teams have embraced that idea. And I don't know where he got it. I think Dean Smith did a lot of that too. And it really helps you manage the unmanageable. Cause man, that tournament is so big and hard to wrap your head around. If you just concentrate on your own path, I think you're a lot better off.
What about Louisville? The, you know, losers of three of their last four, did win against Pittsburgh to end the streak. You've got their game. Have you gotten a chance to look at a lot of their tape, and can you explain why a team that was trending toward having the best defensive year in the KenPom era suddenly lost three straight, one, you know, albeit close to home to Syracuse, a really good team, and then two on the road to Nova and Georgetown. Is there a reasonable takeaway from why they ended up dropping three in a row that you've seen so far?
For me, there is. I think if you look back to last year, even though they had some injuries here and there, it was a similar thing, not necessarily the three in a row, but losing games in a short period based upon who they're playing. If you look at who they played, it was teams that could slow them down, be more physical than others, and kind of get into a Big East slugfest. And then this is not a great shooting team. So if they're not making shots, they can't get their press on, and they can't be disruptive that way. And that affects their ability to score because they score so well off their defense. I think it's one out of 3 points they score off their defense, forcing turnovers, steals, and the like. So the impact of a slower game against bigger teams really affected them. And like you said, you know, the first couple losses they had to Syracuse and I think it was Villanova, they missed a ton of free throws.
Yeah.
So they turned that around. And they handle an end of game situation better. Maybe they win two out of those three and it's not a crisis. But I still think they're just as likely to win this thing as they were before the three game slide.
Interesting. Now, I mentioned on Wednesday's podcast, history actually shows that teams that go through three-game slides don't win the national title. But, you know, that streak ends once somebody does it. So that'll be interesting to see Louisville going forward. I do still very much like the team a lot. But I think I might like Syracuse a little more. And you've got them Monday night against Notre Dame. The only thing with Syracuse is that, you know, we're waiting on Sutherland to come back. The big men haven't produced well. I love Carter Williams' game, even though he's not a consistent shooter. I can't quantify why I like SU so much, but I do think they're actually going to win the Big East title. What are your thoughts on the Orange? Do you disagree with me there? Have they gotten by with that 2-3 zone and a little bit of smoke and mirrors, or is this legitimate talent that should be playing out this way?
I don't differ with you. I think they're very good. I don't think Syracuse is a good shooting team though, and I think they've been able to win a few games. You know, they would have a good record no matter what, but I think they've been able to win a few games that maybe they might have lost because of their shooting issues, because they've been able to make some plays. They've had some guys that made plays at the end of games, like Michael Carter Williams is one of them. And then Jeremy Grant's come in and done a nice job when he's been in there and has made a few plays for him that's helped out. But they don't score in the post particularly well. If they get James Sutherland back, and I guess in another couple games, they've got a chance at that given what happens with this undergraduate judicial board business in the NCAA. If they get him back, that gives them a legitimate shooter, whether he makes shots or not. He's a threat to make shots, and that will open some things up for him. But they're not as good. I don't think they're quite as good defensively as they have been, but they're good. And so I do like them. I think they're top 10 good. I don't think they're as good as they were last year or when they had Wes Johnson a few years ago when they lost Onuwaku that year. I thought they were really good those two times, but just injuries kind of took them out of it. And Matt, I think it showed how good they were last year when they lost the big kid Melo, that they still wind up getting to an Elite Eight and were within shouting distance of beating Ohio State and going to the Final Four.
Yeah, no, for sure. And Boeheim's doing a good job. I love Carter Williams' this game. Is he all right, so I'm by no means an NBA draft guru or anything like that. I'm not nearly the kind of mind you are when it comes to this stuff. But I see Carter Williams, and to me, his game, like, to me, he looks like a 15-year NBA player and a good one at that. Am I projecting a little too much there with him?
No, I agree. I mean, I don't know, 15 years is long for anybody, but yeah, I see him as a long-term pro because he's an open court player. And he can see over defenses. He's got size and length. He can really pass it. Good handler. His error rate is a little high right now, but he's still a kid. I mean, this is really his first year of playing legit minutes. And the one thing he doesn't do yet is shoot it. But I think he's got a good stroke. I mean, I think he's going to become a reliable shooter. But I don't know whether it's good news or bad news. He doesn't know he's not a good shooter. So when he does take a lot of shots that you might cringe at. But I like the fact that he's confident and he wants to be good. And I think he really look. He's good already. He's leading the nation in assists. And he's got when you average four turnovers a game or whatever it is, and still have over a 2-to-1 assist turnover ratio. You've got the goods. He's really, really talented.
All right, how about this one? Just popping in my head. For the college level, you get to pick one. Are you taking Carter Williams, Russ Smith, or Doug McDermott? Which of the three do you take, and why?
For the college level, I would take McDermott because he can play inside and out. He uses the backboard really well. He's pretty efficient. He's tough. And he knows how to play. I don't think he's a good defender, not great. I was able to be around him a little bit at the Nike Skills Academy this summer, the LeBron James Academy, and I was just really impressed with the way he went about his business. So I think as a college player, he's one of the true elites. So are the other guys. I mean, I love Russ Smith. I think he's one of the more dynamic players, and he's fun. He's just fun. Mm-hmm. And he makes plays, and you don't have many guys that can make plays like him. But I think Williams is still a work in progress as good as he is. I think you put McDermott on, one of the more high profile teams where you see him on television all the time. And I think he'd be appreciated on a different level.
All right, let's keep bumping around here. The A-10 is a jumble here. I don't know, how much A-10 film you've seen or games, but for listeners, just to give you an idea, if anyone's listening and doesn't have a really good grasp on what the A-10 shook out to be so far, VCU and Xavier are 5-2. Yeah, Xavier 12-8 overall, but they're just as reliable as anything there. So they're 5-2. They lead the conference. Then Butler, St. Louis, George Washington, UMass, and Charlotte are all at 4-2. And then you get into, like, LaSalle's had a good year. They're 4-3. Temple, 3-3. St. Joe's picked to win the league, 3-3. Then even Richmond and Dayton, both four-loss teams that really can beat anyone. My question is, how good do you see this league? I mean, is this a situation where it's closer to the SEC where it's not a good league and we might take some bad losses? Or is it closer to the Mountain West, which I think is a really good league, and it kind of eats upon itself, but in a good way where it won't damage itself? Do you think the A-10 is setting itself up for, four or five bids, or might it not be quite that good, Jay?
No, I think it's more the latter you're saying about the comparison of the Mountain West.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they're looking at multiple, four or five bids. I don't think that it's a league full of star players, but it's a league full of really good, juniors and seniors and guys that know how to play. I watched the Butler, St. Louis game, and, the thing that BCU and Butler are, they knew it, but I mean, the thing they're finding out, one, everything's new to them. So every road trip is new. There's so much that's new, it's hard to deal with. But the other part is, dealing with bigger bodies. Every team they play, they're dealing with bigger bodies in every game. So you go on the road and play. They could have gone on the road in the Horizon League and played. You play well on those games for Butler, they're going to win. And I think in the CAA, you play well, you're going to win most of the time, not all the time. But in the A-10, there's no guarantee. You can play well and lose, and that to me, that's the sign of a good league. If you go on the road and play well, you can still lose. And those are the ones that are the toughest, in my opinion, to get over. Is when you play well and lose, and then you might play well again and lose, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in danger of a three-game skid. That's when you know you're in a good league, and you got to keep. That's when your mental toughness shows through, and you got to fight through things because things just aren't there. There's no breather where you can get mentally healthy.
Okay. What about Florida? As we continue to bounce around random topics here. 17-2, number one KenPom team, beating teams at a rate in league that's reminiscent in an SEC way of 96 Kentucky. I mean, they're killing everyone here. Number two in overall offense, number one in overall defense, in points per possession. This is becoming a situation where, and I might be getting a little too ahead of myself here, but this is becoming a situation where Florida has a chance to run the table. Now, they still obviously have Kentucky twice. They have Missouri on the road. But I think it's starting to be time here to really recognize how good this Florida team is without having, like, a bona fide superstar. Like, Boynton Young and Murphy and Rosario and Wilbekin, they're all really good players, but none of them are just, top five, top eight in the country good, I don't think. Give me your thoughts on what Florida's doing down there in an SEC that they've made all their own.
I think at the end of the year, we could be looking back saying, how did we not call them the best team in January?
Yeah.
I saw them in person against Wisconsin. And, not that beating Wisconsin at home at that time of the year was, anything to celebrate about as them being the best team. But the way they did it, they just totally took them apart. And you just don't do that to Bo Ryan coach teams. At least I don't see it very often. And I do think they've got really good balance. I think Scotty Wilbekin is kind of the, in a way, has a little Oladipo feel to him that he's so much better than people think. I'm not suggesting that he's as good as Oladipo because I don't think he is. But he's a real point guard that can guard people. He can dish it. He's good in transition. He's poised. And he doesn't need to be patted on the head and told he's a good boy every 5 minutes. I mean, he's really good. And when he was out, they still fought. And I think they're legit and they can win this whole thing. And we shouldn't be surprised, if they wind up in the Final Four. And the other thing it points up to me, Matt, is that Billy Donovan is I think he's Naismith Hall of Fame. I think he's that good and has been for a long time. And I don't know what it is about Gainesville. Maybe it's that oblong ball, but that dude is the real thing. And I remember watching him when he was at Marshall. I used to do some of his games with Marshall, and he had a guy named Keith Meany back then. So the left-handed kid that would score 50 and in games. And I marveled at Billy back then. And I'm even more impressed now. He's the real deal.
And I might put you on the spot here with a little bit of an in-depth question on Florida and Billy and its scheming. But right now, just to give listeners an idea, I mean, Florida is averaging an adjusted defense of 79.7 points per possession on KenPom. That would be far and away a record. No one's even cracked 82 in the past 10 years and since we've been measuring this. So what Florida's doing right now is completely unprecedented. I don't see how it keeps it up, but if it does, it's going to be an all-time defense. Do you know why and how the team has been able to do this? Because this wasn't a great defensive team the past five seasons under Billy, and even the championship years, they were good, but they weren't like ultimate and great. So what's leading to this? How they become such a strong defensive team like this, because no one saw it coming on this kind of level?
Well, I think it's schematic. They're not taking as many chances as they used to, so they're not as much of a denial team. And by that I mean, when they're one pass away, that they're getting out in the passing lane with their back to the ball, trying to take away that pass and force you further out on the floor. So they're not taking as many risks or gambles. And they're playing more zone. So they're more of a, the way I'd put it is they're more of a containment and challenge team. They're containing the dribble better. Help side, they're showing their chest to the ball handler a little bit more and making it difficult to get into the lane. And they're forcing teams to prove it on them over the top. And they're doing a much better job of limiting teams to one shot. And that is not necessarily a sexy way to defend in the half court, but they're still pressing, but doing it really intelligently. And they're not, you know, I think they're more engaged playing five as one rather than gambling and making home run plays on the defensive end. And I think that's one of the reasons they've been a lot better. You know, it's not like they've got unbelievable individual defenders, although Will You Get is as good of an individual defender as I think you're going to find. You know, I mean, say Oladipo's name's going to come up here again, but You Get is one of those guys that can guard a four or five, or he can actually guard a point guard and be really disruptive doing that. I wouldn't want it for an entire ball game, but that guy's really an elite individual defender. So I think it's schematic, and then the guys, you know, it's a group that gets along. It's older. They've won before, and they've been to Elite Eights and didn't break through. And I do think that gives them a little bit of an edge that, you know, they've lost games that they feel like they should have won in key situations. And so I don't think they're getting overly wrapped up in what's happening now. It's important, but I think they'll be really keyed up to do well in the tournament when they've fallen short in the last couple of years.
All right, we'll wrap up the pod with this, Jay. Having been a player, and since you're obviously around so many teams, coaches talk to everybody so often, you really have a sense of how the rhythm of a season plays out. When you get to the end of January and the early February part of the slate, you know, the conference tournaments are coming, but they're not exactly just around the corner because there are still, you know, 7 to 10 games that still need to be played. Does college basketball for a lot of teams have a bit of a dog days of summer feel to it, or is it a short enough season where players and coaches don't get caught in a, you know, a 2-week lull or so? Like right now, when teams are prepping for games this weekend, is it still the same kind of energy that you'll see when the season starts in November, or is it human nature to kind of to hit this spot where they want March to come and they're waiting for it, and this might be a bit of a slump for some kind of teams mentally or physically?
No, I think it's the latter. I think it's a dog days time. I think we're getting, as you get to the second week of February, especially, where you're getting, you know, some of these teams are going to be going through stretches where you're going to have 5 road games and 7, and it starts to feel like you're running uphill, you know, carrying rocks in your backpack. It's tough, and it's especially tough on younger players that haven't done it before. But I think that's where experienced coaches and smart coaches can make a real difference, in that they want, you know, they shorten their practices up. And that gets hard with young teams, Matt, because, you know, you got work that you have to get done, and guys have to get better, but you also have to get them off their feet and keep them mentally fresh. And, you know, when you're watching film and doing these other things that you do to get prepared, that you make sure that it's efficient and that you're presenting it in a way that it doesn't get monotonous and the players get beaten up mentally. Because I think staying mentally fresh, you know, you want, I think as you get to this time of the year, you want fresh minds and fresh legs. If you got those two things, you're going to have a good chance, or at least a better chance than you would have otherwise. But I definitely think there's a dog days aspect to this. And it is, you know, 40 games is a long season.
It's too long.
And so it can be, you know, but it just depends on how it's managed. Yeah. But, you know, these guys are still going to school, and, you know, they got girlfriends and then all this other stuff that, you know, they got real things going on. So it can get difficult.
Yeah, I know. I do sometimes stop and think, like, these kids, I just think about what I was in college and the non-athlete that I was and the things that I did and enjoyed. And then I picture, like, these guys got to play games on the side, and there are real world aspects that can bleed over. And it's key to remember that. But hey, man. Appreciate, you know, you coming back on, maybe closer to Big East. I'll be covering the Big East tournament. We'll do one more swing through the season and catch up. I wanted to go straight games today. I know plenty of people come to you, and I have, on NCAA issues, but we're in the middle of the season, wanted to stick to the hoops, so I put your anti-NCAA rants to the side for today. I hope that's okay.
That's all good with me. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Matt. Huge fan of your podcast. It's great. It's a great listen. Notwithstanding today, when it's a cure for insomnia.
Jay, you're too kind. Thank you for the tweets, man. Enjoy the game this weekend. I hope that's a good one. I hope it's anything close to that Butler game from 2 weeks ago, Butler Gonzaga. That was just that was ridiculous. So if anything can come close to that, you're gonna have a damn good season out there.
Well, I hope so. That's a high standard, but I hope so.
All right. Thank you so much, man. We will be back on Monday with Seth Davis. Look forward to that. Again, subscribe on iTunes. Follow Jay Billis on Twitter if you don't already. He is your go-to for all jokes, good and bad. Trust me. At Jay Billis, J-A-Y-B-I-L-A-S. Thanks again, Jay. We will talk to you on Monday.